Tell the people what you're here for.
Bring everything out closer to the people.
Uh-uh, we got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
You're listening to Radio Basics, the radio wing of Basics Community News Services, bringing news from the people to the people on CHRY 105.5 FM. What up, Toronto? This is Kirithi from Radio Basics and CHRY 105.5 FM. Hope you're all staying warm because it's so icy out there and, you know, I haven't been home in a day or so. Exciting times, exciting times. I'm pretty sure a couple of years down the road people will be talking about this. But anyways, welcome to the show. Haven't been on this for a while, but good to be back. We have an exciting show lined up for you tonight, and I'll be talking about that in a couple of seconds. Yeah, so we're back. And a lot of things been going on around the world here, Toronto, Canada. A lot of things. And today we have an interesting show lined up for you, like I mentioned earlier. Big topic, hot topic. It's about the new new Supreme Court ruling on decriminalizing sex work. So it's going to be a very, very interesting show tonight. Going to have two interviews. One with Maggie's, which is Toronto Sex Worker Action Project, along with another sister from Vancouver, from Grassroots Women's Collective out in Vancouver. So it's going to be a very exciting night. And something else I want to mention today is that in Spain, for instance, I feel like, you know, when it comes to women's rights, women's liberation, women's struggle, it's an ongoing thing. And I feel like this is one of the oldest and ongoing struggle around the world. You know, that the violence against women, the oppression of women, is something that happens, you know, since ages and is still ongoing and still a fight, a hard fight. And right now what's going on in Spain is very interesting. Over the weekend, there were protests in over 20 cities in Spain, and it was about the new anti-abortion law that was recently passed by the conservative government there. And this affects women drastically, you know. So the new hardline abortion law permits the procedures only in cases of rape, serious mental or physical risks to the mother, or life-threatening fetal deformities. So this affects women in multiple ways. For instance, what could possibly happen is there's a reemergence of the abortion tourism, with many women traveling to places like Britain to get these procedures done, you know, and putting themselves at risk. And also, that's not necessarily a privilege that's available to a lot of women. For instance, low-income women would not be able to necessarily do that kind of thing, you know. So it definitely puts a lot of women at risk, because what would essentially happen is women will go underground to underground sources to get these procedures done, putting themselves at risk. And it's just really an oppressive way of looking at things, you know. For me personally, I think it has to be a pro-reality kind of approach to a lot of things out here. But anyways, hey, I don't run things, right? Not yet, at least.
This is CHRY 105.5.
So Radio Basics, we're back, and I'm here with Camila. Hey, Camila, how's it going?
Good, just a little bit accidented. How are you doing?
I'm all right. So you have some other extra stuff you want to talk about for tonight, right?
Yeah, just you know, just a few things that we were looking at today on stuff that as Basics we've covered before. I know that for the May 1st march that as a, you know, as Basics we participated in the May 1st March, trying to reivindicate the labor movement around the world. So anyway, this year there was a protest around Joe Fresh, and around it was focusing on the Bangladeshi workers. As you all know, you know, all the clothes that we wear that's sold here for ridiculously expensive prices at different stores, and what Joe Fresh including them, are made overseas. So, you know, last year there was a fire. Sorry, no, I'm wrong here. But anyway, there was... Oh, yes, no, I was actually right. There was a fire last year in November, and then a factory collapsed in April, both in Bangladesh, and more than 1,100 workers were killed. So... our May 1st March this year, which I actually wasn't at, but I was told and I saw there's a very good video on the Basics website that you can look at. There was a protest around Joe Fresh. Anyway, so today in the news, it came out the police charged the owners of the Bangladeshi garment factory and 11 of the employees of the same factory with homicide for alleged negligence that leading to the death of 112 workers in the fire.
Mm-hmm. That's big.
I know. So, I mean, it was obviously far more than 112 workers that died in both incidents, so the fire and the collapse. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at least there's some kind of, I guess, justice or whatever you want to call it. Because, I mean, obviously, I feel it's not enough. And, you know, all of these issues, worker safety should be addressed. Especially when, you know, I guess we're all pretty much aware of how much the workers are being paid and what...
Right.
Mm-hmm. What all that clothing is being sold for here, right?
Exactly. And it's been, you know, what they're basically getting is pennies, and how much has been sold here, like the profit margin. If you look at anything, mm-hmm. right, it's just... You know, I think a lot of people don't think about the amount of, you know, oppression that we actually send out in waves by buying into this consumerism. And it's actually, I actually read about that whole Bangladeshi thing, and I was actually pretty happy about it. I mean, it's not the end of it all. Like, you know, there's way more to it. And a lot of the issue is the fact that, you know, a lot of the regulations are not necessarily being practiced
mm-hmm.
and, enforced.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the specifics of the factory, like the safety regulations that they weren't complying with, include things like no emergency fire exits, mm-hmm. And stuff like that. So, I mean, those are basic things, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, but right. You know, profit is always over the safety and lives of workers all over. So,
that's
one of the things we mm-hmm. wanted to talk about. And before I got here, I know that you were speaking about Spain,
right? Yeah, and that's something we can talk about later.
Okay,
and maybe
it
just
kind of connects with our interviews and stuff. Mm-hmm, so maybe
right, yeah, we can definitely do a wrap up about that. And right now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to just play this interview we actually did today in the morning with Chanel Gallant, who is a spokesperson for Maggie's, which is, like I mentioned earlier, is a Toronto sex worker action project. So once this is over, we're going to bring in our feature interview with a woman out from Vancouver. Her name is Suzanne Bosted. And yeah, we'll take it from there.
About your reaction to the ruling last week.
Yeah, well, I am absolutely thrilled and delighted, shocked, and also a little bit nervous about what's to come.
How will you think that this will impact the lives of sex workers?
Well, currently there's a stay on implementing the decision, so it's there. You know, it's not having an immediate impact. But if it's implemented and no new legislation is introduced, it could dramatically change things. And most immediately, it would dramatically impact the sex workers who've been pushed to the margins. So sex workers who are street-based, poor, racialized, trans, migrant, LGBTQ, and two-spirited youth stand to gain the most from this decision, and that's where we would see the most dramatic impact in terms of reduction of discrimination, police harassment, arrest, incarceration, deportation, and violence.
So walk us through this. How do you see that those sex workers, that specific population will be most impacted, it will be positively impacted by these potential changes?
So there were three laws that were struck down, and these laws dealt with communicating for the purposes of prostitution in a public place, and that law was specifically used to target street-based workers. The second law was operating a common body house, and that law was used to prevent workers from working indoors together. And the third law was called living on the avails of prostitution, and that law was used to prevent sex workers. It basically criminalized every relationship a sex worker had, and so that included anyone who rented to a sex worker, anyone who would be hired as reception, management, security, anything like that. And so all of those laws were struck down because they were found to be unconstitutional, because they were putting sex workers' lives at risk. So the way that that impacts people's lives is, I'll give you an example of someone who is street-based. So currently, a sex worker working on the street is prohibited from having a basic screening conversation with their client. They can't work out what they're going to do, for how much, and what the safer sex requirements are going to be. They can't take the time to determine whether or not the client matches a description on a bad date list, whether the way they look or their license plate. Mm-hmm. They can't take the time to make sure there's nobody else in the vehicle. They can't work in a place where other people are around, so they're sort of protected by their relationships with other people. They are forced to work in isolated areas. What this means is that people, men who are predators, can slip past the sex worker screening process, because the worker has been forced to do it in a very rushed way, in isolated areas, in the darkness, and without other even people around. It's also illegal even just for sex workers to work with other people on the street. Everything that would create safety is illegal. And of course, sex workers are geniuses, and they're protecting their own lives, so they have a lot of really smart strategies
right. For
doing that screening in and around the law. I mean, and often, you know, street-based workers, their whole lives are criminalized. They have all kinds of life strategies for how to figure out how to keep law enforcement off their backs. And so they work around that stuff. But what was happening is that it was basically as though you're a cyclist in an ice storm and you're prohibited from wearing a bicycle helmet. Just basic safety precautions were criminally prohibited, which is ridiculous and dangerous. And so now what could happen is that worker will be able to work with friends, have a proper screening conversation, work in areas that are more well-lit and populated, clearly outline what service they're going to offer for how much and what the safer sex requirements are going to be, and then take the client to an indoor location, which is now legal. That is currently all illegal. So that's a very dramatic impact on the lives of sex workers. I mean, the laws also facilitated all kinds of profiling, racial profiling and profiling of trans women as sex workers. And this is still going to happen, but they'll have one less tool that they can use.
So at the beginning, you mentioned that you're also a little nervous about all of this. What's behind that? What are the things that you're nervous about potentially?
Well, what we're concerned about and what every sex worker advocate is concerned about right now is the introduction of new legislation, specifically what's called the Nordic model. And this is a anti-sex work legislation that's been introduced in a number of Scandinavian countries that criminalizes clients. So what they claim is that they're decriminalizing the sex worker, who is no longer subject to law enforcement. But the problem is, if you criminalize clients, sex workers still need to work. And so they're still prevented from screening. They're still on the run from the law. It means that clients don't want to provide any screening information because they don't know whether or not the sex worker is an undercover law enforcement officer. So what happens is that sex workers have to accept less and less screening. And again, it's just interfering with and prohibiting safety measures. So we're definitely nervous about that, that we could end up in the exact same situation we're in right now, where sex workers are exposed to discrimination, harassment, violence, and harm, because predators are able to get past the screening measures of sex workers, which are being controlled by law enforcement and not by themselves.
while there is pretty widespread unity amongst kind of progressive sectors around the decriminalization of sex workers themselves, I've seen a bit of discussion generated around how to approach Johns, as you mentioned, the customers, or those commonly referred to as pimps. There's, like you mentioned, the Nordic model. There's other models that are kind of being looked at, New Zealand, Nevada. Are any models available or any specific examples that you're advocating, that your organization is advocating to address some of the other concerns that have been raised around the violence towards Aboriginal women, you know, the issues around human trafficking and sex trade and with regards to forced immigration, any things mm-hmm. like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, you know, to respond to in that question. So first of all, what we support is full decriminalization, which has already been put in place in New Zealand in 2003. And this is similar to after Canada struck down the laws prohibiting abortion and homosexuality. They didn't introduce new legislation. And you can still regulate, for example, abortion, but you don't need the criminal code to do that. So that's the model that sex workers around the world, actually, not just in Canada, but everywhere from Hong Kong to Calcutta to Brazil, to New York, to Sweden, that's what sex workers demand. The sex industry is incredibly diverse. There is no typical experience of sex work. And yet the global movement is unified in its call for decriminalization. And that is because any form of criminalization endangers sex workers' lives. And it especially and firstly endangers the lives of those who are most marginalized. Those are the people who pay the highest price. And we see that with the impact on poor women, Indigenous women, racialized women, and migrant women in Toronto or in Canada. And so because they face the highest enforcement, they're often in the, you know, pushed into the most dangerous aspects of the industry. And so it's not enough for us. And, you know, myself, I don't accept any model that would create a class of safe sex workers and a class of unsafe sex workers, and that's what the Nordic model does. And so if we look at what Indigenous sex workers themselves are calling for, they're calling for decriminalization as well, and I can point you towards some resources to check out, but I would suggest you start by looking at the legacy and the work of Jamie Lee Hamilton in Vancouver, of Monica Forrester in Toronto, and of Naomi Sayers in London, Ontario, and also workers at Stella in Montreal, like Anna Ode. So there's, you know, the support for decriminalization that's come from Families of Sisters in Spirit, from No More Silence, and from Native Youth Sexual Health Network. So it's misrepresentation of the experiences of Indigenous sex workers to talk about criminalization as being an effective solution for Indigenous people. I think it's especially problematic when we look at the colonial experience of the criminal legal system for Indigenous people in Canada, and we look at the rates and the incredibly high rates of violence and incarceration toward Indigenous people from the state. And Maggie's began the first ever project that was led by and for Indigenous sex workers in North America. And this came from the leadership of Indigenous sex workers themselves. And the project was called the Aboriginal Sex Workers Education and Outreach Project. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for us to remember the voices and the leadership of sex workers on the margins who are perfectly capable of advocating for themselves and know the solutions they need to the problems they face. And criminalization is not it. Criminalization of any aspect of their lives, not just sex work. That is one piece of the puzzle for creating real lasting change.
You mentioned at the beginning that you were a little shocked, surprised at the ruling. Part of the reason why a lot of people have been shocked is because obviously this is a Supreme Court which has been mostly promoted to their positions by the most conservative government that Canada's had in a pretty long time, which is also one of the reasons why a lot of folks are actually a little reticent about what the next steps are, because ultimately they're the ones that are kind of in charge of working out some of, you know, these issues that you've raised. What are the next steps, and how do you see that sort of contradiction playing out?
Well, presumably the government is going to try to create legislation that does not violate the constitutional rights of sex workers. And they may be able to do this. I mean, we're working within a colonial state where the violence, the law itself is violent. And so there is limited accountability for the impact that these laws have. And while we had an amazing win on Friday, I also don't believe that state recognition is going to save anybody. I think only we can save ourselves. And I believe in community-based solutions to the problems that we face. And what we will have to use, whatever legal mechanisms we have available to us to stop the introduction of laws that will re-endanger sex workers. And if that means another constitutional challenge, I don't know. I mean, that may be in the cards. I don't know.
Chanel Gallant, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so that was Chanel Gallant from Maggie's, which is, like I said, a Toronto sex worker action project. And actually right now I have Susan Bustad on the phone. Hello, Susan. Hello. Are you there? Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Susan.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Can you just introduce yourself really quickly, perhaps?
Sure. My name is Suzanne Bostad. Where to start? I have experience working primarily in my day-to-day job as a paralegal in immigration and refugee law firm, working with migrant women. I was a co-founder of a local anti-imperialist women's group here in Vancouver called Grassroots Women, which attempted to address... we were active in Vancouver, I guess, for about 15 years, and we worked to address the systematic sort of marginalization of working class women. We had we worked with the Philippine Women's Center and organized around issues of, I guess, health care, child care, trafficking and prostitution, immigration, deportation.
Okay.
So that's kind of my background.
That's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
So maybe we can just, you know, jump right in, you know, like, so with this new Supreme Court ruling, you know, in terms of decriminalizing sex work, what exactly is your stance on this, Ante? Because you have a very very different stance on it. Like, it's like right now in the media, even on Facebook, Twitter, it's such a hot topic, right? And people have all sorts of views, and a lot of people are actually, you know, very pro, you know, decriminalizing sex work, right? On the surface, definitely that you know, like, a lot of people would vibe towards that, especially if you're from the left. But you have a very, very distinct perspective on this. Maybe you can talk a bit about that and the reasons as to why you see it the way you do.
Sure. First of all, I just wanted to... I was listening to the interview with Chantel from Maggie's, and I did want to agree with her that that the decision is a victory for people who have been selling sex, and that's primary and vast majority of those people are women. And I want to say that it is a victory to have those women finally decriminalized. Nobody in this debate has wanted to see the women criminalized, and you know that is a partial victory that they have been finally decriminalized. And like Chantel, I too am nervous about what this government is going to do in the wake of this decision. In terms of my own perspective, I think it's really important to step back from sort of the, you know, what's now in play in the media, and sort of be very clear about what was happening with prostitution law pre-Bedford. Everybody mm-hmm. was unhappy with those prostitution laws pretty well, and especially the way they were being enforced. We know that, first of all, prostitution and the sex industry is as a whole, it's a fairly brutal race and class hierarchy,
both
locally and globally. So this has meant that at the top of the trade, you see this tiny minority of women who say that they choose prostitution as a sort of dynamic career path and an expression of their autonomy and choice. And she's, you know, that woman, you know, I heard her on CBC on Cross Country Checkup yesterday. She was this again, she's always going to be speaking from the top of the trade. She's mm-hmm. educated. She's white. She's got citizenship status, usually in imperialist countries like Canada, the UK, New Zealand. She comes from enough class privilege to keep her off the street and to see her through, you know, setting up independently. She's got a pretty petty bourgeois take on the whole thing.
Right.
She sees herself as an sort of an entrepreneurial businesswoman. And she's most likely to exit sex work pretty early at will, and often by becoming, you know, managing other women in an indoor brothel or becoming a brothel owner or a pimp.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So these are the stated aspirations of the three women who are named in the Supreme Court case in Bedford. But we know that the vast majority of women in the trade, both locally and globally, they enter young, mm-hmm. they're poor, they're racialized, they're indigenous, they're migrant women without status. They're, you know, women with disabilities and addictions. They're trans women who face extreme, you know, discrimination in the workforce. They're women without, you know, childcare. And these women work under very different conditions. These are the women who work in the most dangerous and exploitative conditions in the trade. These are the women on the street because no brothel would take them.
Right.
And if they work indoors, it's the, you know, and in Vancouver, we know that most of the women working indoors are Asian. And they're working without, you know, with very little control in the brothels. So whether on the street or indoors, the women at the bottom of the race and class hierarchy in prostitution have been the ones who face the highest levels of violence from Johns, mm-hmm. and they were the ones that were most likely to be targeted for arrest and police harassment. So that's the ways the laws was working before. The other piece of the law, the way it was working before, is that men buying sex were rarely arrested or charged or convicted of prostitution-related offenses.
Mm-hmm.
In Vancouver, when there was an arrest, they were given what's called pre-charge diversion. So basically you pay $500, go to John School, and avoid any charges. So all that to say is that, you know, nobody was happy with this, the way the laws were, you know, existed and the way they were enforced. This debate is about what to do with the industry, what to do with Johns and pimps. We all agree that the women should be decriminalized.
Mm-hmm.
So we understand that, you know, the government has now got, I guess, a year to come up with some new prostitution laws or to leave the whole thing decriminalized. It's very, very unlikely that any party in power, whether that's Conservatives, Liberals, NDPs, nobody's going to leave it decriminalized. It's just, even in New Zealand, there's not a fully decriminalized system in that sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think for me, what as an abolitionist, over the next year, what we're going to see in the prostitution debates is a struggle over very different visions of women's liberation. And I think what's really going to be important is that we look at actually existing decriminalization and regulated prostitution in different countries, and that I think the debate is primarily going to be, and this is already happening, it's already crystallizing a bit in the debates, you know, between the Nordic model
right.
and the New Zealand decriminalization model.
Yeah, and maybe you can explain that a little further. I know even Chantal mentioned that, but maybe you can go into a bit of detail about that?
Sure. So I guess I'll just tell you a bit about our take on the Nordic as an abolitionist, the take on the Nordic model we have.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that you know, the Nordic model was adopted in Sweden in 1999, and it's again just been recently adopted in France. And the fundamental assumption underneath both of those countries' adoption of the Nordic model is that prostitution is a fundamentally unjust institution, and it's a form of violence against women, and it's a form of commodification of women's bodies.
Right.
So the Nordic model decriminalizes women, but maintains criminal sanctions on Johns and pimps, while providing social supports to women to prevent them from entering the trade and to help them to leave the trade. So there's dedicated exit programs, which is a piece that I guess Chantel forgot to mention about the Nordic model. As an anti-imperialist feminist and abolitionist, I'm pretty clear on which tactical direction we should go, and that would be the Nordic model as a starting point. I think that the vast majority of women in prostitution don't see it as a free choice. It's usually something that they resort to because they lack options, or something they've been coerced into because of larger circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's a good starting point?
Because the vast majority of women in the sex trade, and especially the ones that I'm talking about, the bottom of the trade, the vast majority of those women say they want to leave, and I think we should listen mm-hmm. to those women. Mm-hmm. And at least the Nordic model provides for social supports for women to exit mm-hmm. and acts as a damper on demand so that the industry doesn't grow and expand, and we don't leave it to our daughters and granddaughters to deal with an expanded and entrenched sex industry. But I think abolition is much more than a debate over social policy or legal reform. I think to end prostitution, and in grassroots women, we saw prostitution as an institution, as a colonial institution, as an expression of male supremacy, and as a means to capital accumulation. And that to end prostitution, we need to actually address the material conditions of working class women's lives. And we got to stop separating out sex workers from all women.
Mm-hmm.
All working class women, you know, need pretty well the same things. And I think it doesn't do sex workers any service to treat them as like sort of a special identity or have a special status. So the Nordic model we see as a tactical step in the direction of getting rid of prostitution and addressing some of the material conditions of working class women's lives. So I think for me, the biggest issue in the debate is to try to question the claims that many who are promoting the New Zealand model of decriminalization mm-hmm. and to ask two basic questions. Why now, and who benefits? I think we need to really question why there's a push for the decriminalization of prostitution at this time.
Right.
Why, after 3 decades of neoliberalism and this whole ideology of choice and empowerment, and 3 decades of neoliberal state abandonment of women, especially mm-hmm. working class women,
yeah.
in terms of cuts to social programs, and after, you know, an increased displacement of women locally and globally because of colonial pressures on indigenous lands and imperialist wars of occupation, why now, in this context, mm-hmm. is sex work and the legal infrastructure for sex work becoming, a possibility as a new social safety net for working class women and this new neoliberal version of women's liberation? So mm-hmm. I think we really need to think about that
mm-hmm.
and to challenge that whole view that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, women are going to have this new baseline that's going to be,
right.
You know, whether it's coming from your social worker, from, you know, from your welfare worker, from EI, it's like, well, that's a job. There's the job possibility for you.
Right.
And so, in terms of who benefits, I think we really need to look at, mm-hmm. you know, we've had a lot of celebration around decriminalizing of the women, but not much is being said about the fact that pimps and johns are also decriminalized, and that what we're seeing really is the emergence and development of a sex industry in Canada, and that, like we see in New Zealand and most areas of the world where we've got a decriminalized prostitution regime, the sex industry has become big business. And it's clear, for example, in New Zealand, you see it's undergoing a process of monopolization.
Mm-hmm. Right, so, and it's booming, right?
Booming. Mm-hmm. And we get, you know, 2 days after the decision, the Adult Entertainment Association of Canada, which includes strip clubs in Canada, mm-hmm. they've come out saying they're going to take advantage of decriminalization by offering what they're calling enhanced services in strip clubs. So it's, you know, it's those who are going to profit who have really seen that this decision, the potential of this decision.
I'm going to stop you there for a quick second, and we're going to go in for a quick commercial break, and we're going to be back, okay?
You're listening to CHRY 105.5, your leading source for diversity.
Okay, so CHRY 105.5 FM, Radio Basics, we're back, and we're back to our conversation with Suzanne. Suzanne, so we just left off earlier before the break. We were just talking about New Zealand and how the industry there is booming, especially the sex trade industry, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we can just continue that conversation from there?
Sure. Well, we've seen, for example, the emergence of sort of the big capitalists who are shaping the industry, in particular one mega project that's in the works now. It's a mega brothel that will be integrated into the entertainment industry. It's a 15-story super brothel which will be located across the street from the country's largest casino and convention center. So they're going to cater to about 3,500 guests, and there will be about 400 sex workers that will be employed in that scenario. I think the New Zealand, for me, it's important to look at the emergence of a sex industry, and what we're seeing in Canada is the restructuring of an already existing sex industry. And I really think that New Zealand's instructive for, to address the question of safety. A lot of claims are made that sex workers are safer in a fully decriminalized system like New Zealand, but I think that there's a really, we really have to challenge that. And I heard Chantel making that, saying that the women in, the most marginalized women have the most to gain, and I would really, really challenge that assumption.
Right.
First of all, sort of no decriminalized system makes any great claims to keep women safer. Women are still being raped. They're still being beaten and killed by Johns in the Netherlands, in Germany, and in New Zealand. And I know of at least two women who were killed by Johns in New Zealand in the last few years. Countries like Germany and Netherlands, in fact, are going back. They're pulling back from decriminalization experiments because they've seen the growth of an illegal sector and the increased trafficking of women. In any case, any research that makes a claim for greater safety have to be looked at really critically, and we know that the most recent government report on prostitution law reform in New Zealand actually excluded non-English-speaking sex workers.
Oh, wow.
So
that's really interesting, because a lot of the sex workers there are coming from Asia, parts of Asia, right?
Exactly. Mostly, Malaysia, China. Yeah, no, it was quite astonishing, actually. And it certainly paid. Once you factor out those women, you certainly have a rosier picture of the trade. So when we're talking about safety but after decriminalization, we do really have to ask who exactly is going to be safer. If regulations on the books make women safer, and that's a big if, I was going to talk about that in a minute, then women in the illegal sector remain without the protection of those regulations. So we know that wherever the sex industry has been decriminalized, there's always a large illegal sector that grows alongside the increased demand in the legal sector. So we know that in countries where prostitution is decriminalized, the vast majority of the trade happens outside of that legal and regulated trade, and there's reasons for that. They want to avoid identification, taxes, regulations, plus the fact that many of the women still remain criminalized. And that, again, Chantel failed to mention that about New Zealand, that many of the women are still criminalized. If they're underage, they're criminalized. If they're migrant women, they're criminalized. You have to be a New Zealand citizen or a permanent resident to actually work legally in the trade. So what we're seeing is that, these arguments made for safety in the Bedford case claim that women who, have been preyed on by Picton would be safer, but we know that's not true. They're the same women that have always been at the bottom of the prostitution hierarchy, and they will remain outside of a legal sector. In New Zealand, the women at the bottom of the hierarchy haven't seen the benefits of decriminalization. They're certainly not safer. In fact, there's one Maori, which is indigenous people, in case you don't know, in New Zealand. She's an outreach worker. Her name's Mama Tara Strickland, who was on the street for 25 years. She's been highly critical of decriminalization, and she's said she's seen only the increased numbers of women in the trade, but not improved conditions. So in New Zealand, we know street-based workers have not moved indoors, largely for the same reasons that they didn't work in massage parlors before. And they continue to face high levels of violence, including, like I said, the murders that I talked about before. Strickland calls prostitution in New Zealand, she actually calls it an apartheid system, where Maori and Pacifica women, along with migrant women, remain on the streets and in the worst conditions in the brothels. They haven't seen the protections supposedly offered through decriminalization. And women, migrant women, remain criminalized, like I said, as they do in all decriminalized regimes, and they will most likely be in Canada. So when you're talking about, you know, safety through regulations in the legal sector, you have to consider that when you create that legal sector, you increase demand, you increase the illegal sector. So who are the women that are going to be safer?
Right.
So, you know, meanwhile, you know, women on the street, they continue to be harassed by the police, maybe not under criminal law sanctions around prostitution, but through municipal bylaws. And they're harassed by resident groups, and they're harassed by brothel owners who fear unfair competition. But unlike the Nordic model in New Zealand, there's not one dedicated exit program for those who want to exit the trade. Those at the top of the trade have resisted exit programs, saying the concept is insulting to sex workers and sends the wrong message about the industry. Because after all, if sex work is like any other work, then you wouldn't need an exit program for McDonald's. So why would you need an exit program for prostitution? So, you know, the women at the bottom of the trade are saying we want out. In New Zealand, the conditions haven't improved for them, the safety hasn't improved, and they don't have exit programs.
Right, right. Now let's come back to Canada. What do you anticipate the government will do? Like, would it be a process where they would have to register themselves into the system? Like, what exactly do you vision could possibly happen, you know, in the next year?
I'll bet all bets are off. I don't really know. Nobody knows.
Mm-hmm.
In the Conservative Party, there's a base that would like to see the entire industries criminalized, including the women. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's going to be, I don't think the courts are going to allow that, the continued criminalization of the women. So, you know, there's various different models, right? You know, Chantel talked about, you know, they're pushing for the New Zealand model. That's the model that Libby Davies of the NDP, federal NDP, has also pushing for. There's, you know, different variations on regulations. What we need to know, what we need to remember, oh, I mean, just a second, my phone is dying. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear
okay,
you.
No sorry. Problem. What we need to know is that every time you do some sort of regulation in a decriminalization model, you exclude people from the legal sector. So, like we've seen in, you know, the Netherlands, Germany, New Zealand, migrant women are usually, you know, they remain criminalized. And in Canada, I'm assuming, I work with migrant women every day, I'm assuming that they will remain criminalized.
Mm-hmm. Same thing.
So everything that we say about safety under a decriminalized model does not apply to migrant women. Yet these are the women Canadian women don't want to do this work. There's a huge demand for it that's created when the industry is deregulated or decriminalized. Who is going to fill that supply? Who's going to fill that demand? Mm-hmm. It's going to be women. Like we see all over the world, 80% of the women in the Netherlands in their trade are not Dutch women, right?
Right. Yeah.
So the vast that tells you right there that the vast majority of the women that come here to work in a legalized trade will remain in the unregulated sector.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a very, I mean. You have to. I think over the next year, we're going to have a chance to actually have more debates around what is the model that works, and if we're talking about safety, what is the model that works?
For sure, and it's going to be an ongoing process, right? And
right.
I think at this point in time, we can only start the discussion.
Mm-hmm. And I think exactly, and I think people have to. You know, I hear you know, people saying, oh, there's unity in the left, there's unity, you know, amongst sex trade workers. And that's actually, I don't think, the case. And I think that there is a lot of debate that has to happen because, you know, this has huge implications, especially for working class women who are most likely to have to resort to prostitution.
Sure.
You know, so I think these debates really do have to happen, and they have to happen from, you know, principled positions. There are prostituted women, sex workers, on both sides of this debate. Mm-hmm. When we hear, oh, you must listen to sex workers. Well, you know, there's women with experience in the sex trade on both sides of this debate. So we need to have a principled debates on these things, and we need to have, you know, a really clear vision of what it is that we see, you know, where what does prostitution mean, and what does it mean for women's liberation?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, those are the kinds of things I'd like to see.
For sure. Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's also good that, you know, to clarify that this first Supreme Court ruling is definitely, I mean, a victory or a partial victory. Again, I wanted just to clarify that point, that in general, like the general opinion is the fact that whatever the case, women have to be decriminalized for engaging in this work.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really interesting what you were just mentioning earlier, and it brings me to, you know, a lot of questions in my mind about how this, you know, this one ruling is kind of, you know, if you put it into a context where women are being, I guess, like social securities and things like that are being, you know, taken away from us, like things, you know, education, job security, childcare, and stuff like that. If you look at the whole context, it definitely, you know, it kind of, I'm not saying it doesn't mean anything, but, you know, you need all of those things in place for all of them to work together. Otherwise, you have, I guess, what is very fertile ground for a booming sex industry, which is what we were talking about in New Zealand, right? Where the entertainment industry is like, whoa, like let's get in on this, right?
Yeah,
this is awesome.
Hotel,
let's make some money.
Mm-hmm.
And it also brings me, a good example of this would be, I'm from Chile, and, you know, like the education is a big issue there, and the protests are ongoing, and they have been ongoing for 6 years now. And I'm from a small town in the south of Chile where there's one big university, and there's also one well-known brothel in a little, like a one neighborhood, and everyone knows about this brothel. And it's very well known that young women from our school, from our university that I used to assist, a lot of the time end up going to that brothel to pay for, having to pay for, and this is because the lack of, you know, the education that Chileans are fighting for, right? So, I mean, if that weren't in place, if that weren't situation, maybe a whole bunch of young women would not feel the need to go and do this, right? So, I mean, we have to look at all of these things when we
approach this.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good point, and that, you know, it's actually interesting you say that. When the same strip association, the Adult Entertainment Association of Canada, when temporary foreign workers used to get visas to come and work as exotic dancers, and when they were canceled last summer, the association came out and said, "Well, we're just going to have to recruit from, you know, from university students, especially international students."
Mm-hmm.
So that whole industry is set up and geared. They actually created a pamphlet saying, you know, it's flexible hours, good money, you can pay off your, you know, your student loan, you don't have to go into so much debt. And, you know, that's a real attractive thing for I know, me and my student loan, you know, it's been a, you know, albatross around my neck. So, you know, that's it's a very critical piece of, because it is going to be young women that are going to be the ones that are targeted by this industry.
Definitely.
For sure.
Well, Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us today. It was such a good conversation, and I think we need to hear more of this. And we definitely, on Radio Basics, will be following this, and, you know, we'll definitely have a follow-up sometime in the future, with the next year or so. And, thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you so much for inviting me.
All right. Have a good night.
Bye,
you
Suzanne.
Too.
Thanks.
Keep warm out there. Right?
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Yeah.
So that was Suzanne from the Grassroots Women's Collective from Vancouver, and she definitely had some really valid points to talk about. So we're at a wrapping time right now. We're past 9 o'clock. But, you know, definitely think about some of the things that we discussed today, and, you know, hit us up if you have any questions, concerns. Like I always say, radiobasics@gmail.com. Hope you enjoy the show tonight. And we're just going to leave you with the blues show coming up next.
And make sure to stay posted on the webpage. There mm-hmm. is an article that will be right. posted soon about this
exactly.
this issue. So, mm-hmm. you know, just it's basicsnews.ca.
Yeah.
So stay posted on that.
All right, Toronto, have a good night, and yes, stay warm.
Stay warm.